Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, June 7th, 2017, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we'll hear a Courthouse Steps decision telephone on Impression Products v. Lexmark International, a decision handed down by the Supreme Court on Monday. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today we are happy to have with us Professor Adam Mossoff, Professor of Law at the Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University, Mr. Stephen Tepp, President and CEO of Sentinel Worldwide and Professorial Lecturer in Law at George Washington University Law School, and our moderator, Professor Kristen Osenga, who is a professor of law at the University of Richmond. I will turn it over to Professor Osenga to get us started. After opening remarks, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Professor. The floor is yours.
Thank you. As Laura mentioned, today we will be discussing the recent Supreme Court opinion in Impression Products versus Lexmark International. The opinion was authored by Chief Justice Roberts and was handed down on May 30th. The issue in this case is what activity by a patentee exhausts his patent rights in an item. I'll first discuss the background of the case and then give you the basics of the Supreme Court opinion before turning it over to our experts. Lexmark makes and sells patented ink cartridges for its printers. It sells cartridges under two different programs. One program is a typical sale, allowing buyers to use the cartridges as they wished. The second program was known as the return program and provided ink cartridges at a discounted rate, but then limited the buyers to using the cartridge a single time and requiring the buyers to return the cartridge to Lexmark for recycling. Lexmark sued a number of companies that made aftermarket ink cartridges for Lexmark printers, alleging patent infringement. In the lawsuit against Impression Products, the district court entered judgment that Lexmark's patent rights were exhausted for those cartridges first sold in the United States, but that Lexmark retained patent rights in those cartridges sold abroad. The Federal Circuit heard the case en banc and held that where a patentee's sale is subject to a single-use, no-resale restriction that was lawful and clearly communicated, as was the case in Lexmark's return program, the sale does not confer to the buyer an ability to resell or reuse the item. The Federal Circuit also held that the patentee's sale of a United States patented item abroad does not authorize the buyer to import the article and sell it in the United States. In both cases, the patentee retains some patent rights, according to the Federal Circuit. The Supreme Court granted cert in the case to consider the doctrine of patent exhaustion. Patent exhaustion holds generally that an initial authorized sale of a patented item terminates all patent rights to that item. The court took the case to consider two questions of, and I quote from the Supreme Court, great practical significance regarding the scope of this doctrine. So the two questions presented in this case were this. First, whether a conditional sale that transfers title to the patent item, while specifying post-sale restrictions on the article's use or resale, avoids application of the patent exhaustion doctrine and therefore permits enforcement of such post-sale restrictions through the patent law's infringement remedy. And second, whether, in light of the Supreme Court's holding in the Kurtzsang versus John Wiley and Sons case, that the common law doctrine, barring restraints on alienation that is the basis of the exhaustion doctrine, makes no geographical distinctions. A sale of a patented article authorized by the U.S. patentee that takes place outside of the United States exhausts the patent rights in that article. So the Supreme Court reversed the Federal Circuit's decision on both questions of domestic and international exhaustion, and the court nicely summed up their decision for us. Quote, we conclude that a patentee's decision to sell a product exhausts all of its patent rights in that item, regardless of any restrictions the patentee purports to impose or the location of the sale. Thus, the minute Lexmark sold its patented cartridges, it exhausted its patent rights, regardless of whether the sale was made as the normal sales go or under the return program, and regardless of whether the sale was made in the United States or outside of the United States. With respect to the issue of the post-sale restrictions, the Supreme Court explained that the Federal Circuit was incorrect in its interpretation of the exhaustion doctrine. The Federal Circuit believed that patent exhaustion was based on a grant by the patentee to use and resell the patented article, allowing the patentee to avoid exhaustion by not handing over a complete bundle of rights. Instead, the exhaustion doctrine, as the Supreme Court noted, limits the patentee. A sale transfers the right to use, sell, or import because those are the rights that come along with ownership, and the buyer is free and clear of an infringement lawsuit because there is no exclusionary right left to enforce. To find otherwise, the court noted, would greatly hinder the economy, illustrating this point by way of an auto repair shop. Quote, if companies that make thousands of parts go into a vehicle could keep their patent rights after the first sale, end quote, these industries and markets would go under. With respect to the return program, Lexmark still maintained rights as a matter of contract law, but once the cartridges were sold, they were no longer part of Lexmark's patent monopoly. This point was further supported by the court's distinguishing between sales and licensing of patented items in the opinion. With respect to this issue of international sales, the Supreme Court cited its Skritzen case that held that the first sale doctrine of copyright law had no geographical distinctions. An authorized sale outside of the United States of a patented item exhausts the patentee's rights, according to the Supreme Court, and thus Lexmark had no infringement claim for products imported by Impression Products. Although Skritzen was a copyright case, the Supreme Court noted that differentiating between patent exhaustion and copyright first sale doctrines makes very little sense. Justice Ginsburg concurred with the majority as to patent exhaustion from a domestic sales, but did disagree with respect to exhaustion from sales made abroad. And with that very brief introduction to the case, I want to turn it over to today's experts, Adam Mossoff and Steve Tepp, to cover the legal and policy implications of the opinion. Professor Mossoff will start.
Thank you, Kristen. And it's a pleasure to be on the telephone today to talk about the Supreme Court's decision in Impression Products from this past May 30th. for many people who are patent law geeks and have been following the Supreme Court's engagement in patent law, they'll know that this is very much a follow-up decision to the Supreme Court's decision in Quantum Computers versus LG Electronics in 2008, which addressed a very similar and related question pertaining to the ability to impose restrictions on licenses and sales of patented products, but which left open the question as to whether exhaustion was a per se rule or a default presumption that one could contract out of through a conveyance instrument, whether it's an assignment or or some other type of conveyance of one's property rights, such as a license. And so I'm going to primarily focus on the domestic aspect of the exhaustion doctrine, because that was, in fact, the most shocking part of the opinion from my perspective, where Chief Justice Roberts hands down an absolute per se rule resolving the confusion left by Quanta that all sales of patented products exhaust all property rights in the product as they pertain to the patent rights that cover it. And in doing so, Chief Justice Roberts invoked this alleged 160-year-old precedent that he said, you know, this is a long-standing rule, this rule of absolute exhaustion, referring and quoting from Chief Justice Roger Taney's decision in Bloomer v. McQueen from 1853. But this is really a shocking claim for him to make, and quite a surprising reference, because patent law historians, myself included, but many others, Sean O'Connor and others, have long recognized that the portion of the opinion to which Chief Justice Roberts cites and relies upon itself was at the time recognized as dicta. It represented a policy-driven agenda by Chief Justice Roger Taney, who anyone who knows him should well know that he had proclivities to engaging in policy-driven agendas in his Supreme Court decisions, not just in patent law, but in other areas of law, including constitutional law. And in fact, it was not based in the law at that time, either in the patent statutes. In fact, it directly conflicted with the patent statutes, as well as it conflicted with longstanding established practices at that time with respect to the commercialization of patented innovation by many people in the antebellum era, including Charles Goodyear's invention of vulcanized rubber, Samuel Morse's invention of the telegraph, Samuel Colt's invention of the repeating firearm, Eli Whitney's invention of the cotton gin, and so on and so on. So despite the fact that Chief Justice Roberts claims that he is upholding a long-standing 160-year-old rule, he in fact is upending more than 200 years of settled commercialization practices in the innovation economy in the United States in the sale and use of property rights at all points along the value chain, both the production portion of it and the distribution portion of it. Because contrary to Chief Justice Roberts' kind of quaint example of the sale of a car, the fact of the matter is that property owners, particularly real property owners, have imposed restrictions and transferred lesser interests in their property, whether they are restricted covenants or whether they are lesser estates, all the time. In fact, this was the model for what later becomes known as patent exhaustion. In the 19th century, it was not known as patent exhaustion doctrine because this was just how you transferred property rights. And in fact, at the time, the courts repeatedly cited to real property cases and common law and relied upon those in adjudicating and enforcing these types of post-sale restrictions of lesser estate interests of patent rights and patented products in the marketplace. And in fact, they imposed the same doctrinal restrictions from real property that evolved at common law into patent law. And so, for instance, just as the real property market doesn't collapse because people don't know if they're purchasing houses that is less than a full fee simple because there has to be an express writing of those limitations, and there has to be notice, either actual notice or constructive notice. And you saw the exact same restrictions and doctrinal requirements applied in the patent cases all along over through Supreme Court and lower case cases where they recognized that Taney had said, oh yes, the patents are just the right to exclude, so when you sell in the marketplace, you've exhausted your right to exclude. But that was Chief Justice Taney's view of patents as franchise monopoly grants, a view and perspective that Chief Justice Roberts adopts, shockingly, in this opinion. And all the other courts at the time recognized that's not how the patents are actually treated under the patent statutes of the time or under the existing judicial interpretations of the patent statutes, and the fact that they were treated as real property interests and similar to those interests in the extent to which in which property owners had the ability to impose restrictions on the sale of patented products as long as they did so through express language and purchasers and follow-on successors and assigned had notice of those expressly written down restrictions. And so what then happens here in Impression Products is that and what one notices when one reads the opinion is he quickly jumps, Chief Justice Roberts quickly jumps from this 160-year-old precedent, Bloomer v. McQueen, to reliance upon all of these early 20th century cases. He relies on Strauss v. Victor Talking Machines from 1917, the Boston Store of Chicago versus American Gramophone from 1918, the United States versus Univis decision from 1948, which also played a significant role in the Quanta decision back in 2008, the United States versus General Electric decision from 1926, and the Motion Pictures Patents versus Universal Film Manufacturing decision from 1917. Well, what's significant about these six primary precedents that Chief Justice Roberts relies upon is that none of them are patent cases. They are all, in fact, antitrust cases. And so what Chief Justice Roberts ends up doing is invoking this dicta from 1853 and then mixing early 20th century antitrust doctrines with patent law. And in fact, it's even worse because what he's mixing is not even contemporary antitrust doctrines, because the reason why those cases in the early 19-teens, 20s, and 40s reached the decisions that they did was because at that time antitrust had per se rules against these types of restrictions being imposed by businesses who were commercializing their products in the marketplace. And antitrust has since recognized that those rules are inefficient and in fact not workable and in fact undermine consumer welfare, and so they've actually shifted to a rule of reason analysis under today's contemporary antitrust doctrine. But instead what you have is this importation of these now antiquated, abrogated antitrust rules in antitrust of the early 20th century into patent doctrine, and the destruction, therefore, of the very essence of what it means to have a property right, which is that you have the right to commercialize it in the marketplace and freely convey it to other people with whatever restrictions or limitations or slices of the property estate interest that you have, as long as you do so with express written language and that there's notice to all parties, including successors and assigns. So at the end of the day, why have property owners have had these long-standing doctrinal rights to engage in this kind of slicing and dicing of their property interests? It's because this is what achieves economic efficiencies in the marketplace. This is the foundation for a successful and flourishing free market, whether you're talking about a free market in the sale of real property and tangible property interests, or whether you're talking about an innovation economy driven by new inventions and new innovations. In fact, it's very revealing in this case itself that the recipients of the Lexmark toner cartridges who obtained them with the reuse and restyle restrictions that were imposed by Lexmark did so by paying a discount. So they paid less because, of course, just like if you sell a life estate interest in your property and not a full fee simple interest, the person will pay less for it because they're not obtaining the full property, right? The people who obtained these printer cartridges with the resale and reuse restrictions paid less for them because they weren't obtaining a full interest in what they were obtaining. And this is exactly what you want in the marketplace, because this is what makes it possible for companies to efficiently deploy products and services all along the value chain to make them available to people who have price points at very different levels given their conditions in their life, whether they have lower incomes or higher incomes and other types of concerns. And so this has been completely and utterly wiped out foundationally and doctrinally in this decision where Chief Justice Roberts, invoking this kind of monopoly perspective of patents that Chief Justice Taney had in 1853 as a Jacksonian Democrat, in saying that, nope, when you transfer a patented product to the marketplace as a per se absolute rule, you are now outside the bounds of the exclusive monopoly that's been conferred upon you by the government, and therefore you no longer have the ability to control this. This is the exact opposite view of what patent rights have been in the United States for well over 200 years, and we will actually see the unfortunate consequences of this in the coming years. So thank you.
Did I just jump in now? I'll take that as a yes. Hi, this is Steve. Thanks, Adam. Thanks to the Society for having me back to discuss this issue. It's a pleasure to participate. And I should start with the disclaimer that my remarks are my own and not necessarily reflective of the views of any client or employer. So I'm going to offer a view of this decision through a copyright lens, which is more my perspective. And while, of course, this is a patent case, the Supreme Court has been hearing a series of international exhaustion cases, including the Quanta case that Adam mentioned, but also in copyright over about the past 20 years. And in this decision, they expressly tied the copyright and patent exhaustion issue together. On the international exhaustion side of the decision, it seems to me that it's pretty clear at least seven justices have a policy preference in favor of exhaustion, and they were going to find a way to get there, full stop. In the process, it seems to me they glossed over the differences between patent and copyright. Specifically, the issue of international exhaustion has been specifically legislated in the Copyright Act in a way that it hasn't been done in the Patent Act. Copyright, as many of you may know, has a set of enumerated rights in Section 106, including the distribution right. And back in 1908, the Supreme Court heard a case, Bobbs Merrill versus Strauss, in which a publisher purported, by virtue of terms printed inside a book, to stipulate the resale price for that book. And the court refused to enforce those, holding that there's a first sale doctrine. Once the first sale has occurred, the distribution right has been exhausted. That made it into the rewrite of the Copyright Act that Congress undertook in 1909, and that was the first sale doctrine for decades. In the 1976 Act, however, Congress took a different tact. They kept the principle of the first sale doctrine, and we still refer to it as the first sale doctrine, but in fact it no longer has anything to do with a first sale taking place. It's simply a question of whether or not someone is the owner of a lawfully made copy. And if they are, then the distribution right as to that particular copy is no longer in force. It is exhausted. A At the same time, in the 1976 Act, Congress created an express importation right, and it in Section 602 of the Copyright Act, and it said that that importation is an infringement of copyright of the exclusive right to distribute. So along comes, well, so first of all, with all that statutory law, there's not really a need to look into a common law question, as arguably is the case in patent. Nonetheless, the court did go to common law, both in the copyright cases on this subject and again, even with reference to copyright in the Lexmark decision. So in 1998, the Supreme Court was faced with an issue, Quality King versus Lonza, of products that were made in the United States, shipped to the UK for sale there, purchased and imported back into the United States in an arbitrage type style business. The product was shampoo, and you may be wondering why in the world shampoo is copyrightable. Of course it isn't, but the label on the bottle was. And so that was the basis of the copyright claim. And the court said, well, the item was created in the United States, and therefore it was lawfully made under this title. And so it was shipped to the UK and shipped back. That's all well and good. Fact is, it was created here lawfully, and so the first sale doctrine, as it's currently codified, applies. That left open the question of what happens if something is made outside the United States, even with the permission of the copyright owner. Is it lawfully made under this title as Section 109 currently requires in the statute? And that came up in the Costco versus Omega case, where Omega watches, watch faces can be copyrightable, although as anyone who follows issues of utilitarian objects and copyright knows, that's a sticky wicket. But Omega had a tiny little engraving on the back of the watch that was sufficiently copyrightable as to sustain their copyright claim, and that was the basis for that case. The Supreme Court split 4-4 on that case, which brought us to the Kurtzeng decision in 2013, which actually involved a purely copyrightable work, textbooks. Supap Kurtzeng was a Thai national who came to Cornell University. His family bought up copies of textbooks that were for sale in Thailand, sent them to Supap here in Ithaca, and he resold them here at quite a profit. My understanding is he made well into the six figures. Wiley and Son sued for violation of the importation right, and the Supreme Court was squarely faced with this question of, were copies made abroad in Thailand with the authority of the copyright owner lawfully made under this title, even though this title doesn't apply abroad? And the Supreme Court said, yes, they were lawfully made under this title, as the statute means it, and therefore the first sale doctrine as currently codified applies, the distribution right has been exhausted, and Kurtzeng has not infringed copyright. It's worth noting that the Supreme Court, in this case, notes the territoriality of the Copyright Act again, but in any event. So all of that is background to the fact that in this case, in comparing patent to copyright, the Supreme Court cites to a 1913 copyright case as support for their international exhaustion conclusion in this case. Of course, that was under the 1909 Copyright Act, which really did involve a first sale question, not the lawfully made under this title question, which the court had just addressed in the Kurtzeng case a few years ago. So it seems a little disingenuous to cite a case under a substantially different statute, and hard to imagine that the court wasn't familiar with the particulars. So I share Adam's skepticism and concern about the international exhaustion side of this case. Turning to the domestic exhaustion and the question of license versus sale, this is where I think there may be some difference. The court said that it seemed to think that it was doing something very modest, if my reading is right. I think Adam's argument to the contrary is persuasive. it seemed to be saying, look, patent owners don't get a right to control the particular product after it's been sold, and so they can't create a patent right by license that they didn't receive in the first place. And if you buy the premise, then that seems logical. I think Adams made a compelling case as to why the premise might not be wrong, might not be right, excuse me. Turning to the practicality of the business world, as we all know, both patent and copyright owners have long been permitted and have in fact included terms and licenses that are not necessarily compelled by the underlying IP. There's nothing wrong with that. Two parties agreeing to mutually acceptable terms should enjoy a broad range of freedom of contract. The fact that the IP is what brought them to the table doesn't restrict their ability to be creative in the negotiation. In particular interest to the issue of the distribution right and its exhaustion, in certain copyright sectors, there's a long history of using licensing terms to stipulate that a marketplace transaction is a license and not a sale, and thus that the end user is not an owner, quote unquote, of the copy. By terms of the current statute, since Section 109 requires that a person be the owner of a lawfully made copy, then that license would contract around the first sale doctrine, which would not apply. And I'm sure everyone on the call is familiar with click-through licenses, and you can often find these types of terms in those licenses if you take the time to scroll down. And there are some, often from the copyright skeptic camp, who dislike those types of terms. Nonetheless, the contract, they've been litigated and they've been consistently upheld. What was foreseeable, and I think has already started to happen, is that people of that perspective are trying to characterize the Supreme Court's decision from last week as changing the law on this question in their favor. But it's pretty clearly not what the court said. In fact, they appear to have said the opposite. The court spoke in terms of limiting the ability to vindicate license terms through infringement suits, but not through contract suits. Looking at the bottom of page 11 and onto page 12 of the slip opinion, the court says, and pardon me for a moment as I quote from it, a patentee's authority to limit licensees does not, as the Federal Circuit thought, mean that patentees can use licenses to impose post-sale restrictions on purchasers that are enforceable through the patent laws. So long as a licensee complies with the license when selling an item, the patentee has in fact authorized the sale. That licensee sale is treated for purposes of patent exhaustion as if the patentee made the sale itself. Okay, fine. The result, the sale exhausts the patentee's rights in that item. A license may require the licensee to impose a restriction on purchasers, like the license limiting computer manufacturer to selling for non-commercial use by individuals. But if the license does so by perhaps having each customer sign a contract promising not to use the computer in business, the sale nonetheless exhausts all patent rights in the item sold. The purchasers might not comply with the restriction, but the only recourse for the licensee is through contract law, just as if the patentee itself sold the item with a restriction. So while the question of patent law here remains controversial, it's pretty clear to me that the ability of licensors to vindicate license terms through contract law is alive and well. Now, that creates a question of privity of contract, and where companies don't have privity of contract with the end user or consumer of their products, this decision gives them a strong incentive to require agreement to terms by consumers at the point of sale. And that may not always be efficient, to be perfectly blunt. This decision may do more harm than good in that respect. As I mentioned though already, it's commonly the case in certain copyright-intensive products currently on the market. So in that regard, I don't see a lot of disruption. And maybe I'll just stop there and we can open it up to questions.
Thanks, Steve, and thanks, Adam. I'm going to turn it back now to Laura to open it to questions from the audience.
Great, let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you will hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. While we wait for that first question, I'll make a brief announcement. Our next Teleforum conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, Thursday, June 8th. That call will be another Courthouse Steps Decision Teleforum, this time on a criminal law case that came out last week entitled Esquivel-Santana v. Sessions, featuring Vikrant P. Reddy, Senior Policy Analyst at the Center for Effective Justice at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. Looks like we have a caller, so let's go to our first question.
My question regards the status of the previous Supreme Court decision in Bowman v. Monsanto, which was the famous Roundup Ready soybean case. Is that still good law in your opinion, or is that now of questionable value?
I'll take that as the as a classic patent law geek question, which I am a proud member of that category. And it's a great question. Bowman v. Monsanto, for those who don't know the case, it was a decision from about 4 years ago, involved, as is mentioned, post-sale and post-use restrictions on the genetically modified seeds that Monsanto sold to farmers, which has resulted in incredible efficiencies and incredible gains in crop yields that have made possible the feeding of the billions of people that now live on our planet. And that case still is good law, but only because the court made it very clear in its decision in that case that given the unique characteristics of seeds and the way that they're reused by farmers and things of that sort, that they were upholding the restrictions in this instance in only this specific area of inventive activities, meaning genetically modified seeds, because of the nature of the seeds and the nature of the massive R&D investments that have to be undertaken in order to create those genetically modified seeds. And so they basically the Supreme Court's creating a very fragmented patent system where what you are now getting are very different substantive rules depending upon different types of technology, which, by the way, is exactly counter to what you're supposed to have when you apply a property rights approach to a legal regime, whether it's property rights in land or other types of tangible resources, or as originally framed patents, which is that property functions in part because it provides a uniform, stable platform of generalized categories of the exclusive rights of acquisition, use, enjoyment, and disposal, of which then you apply them contextually given the subject matter, but those rights are the same set of rights that travel to whatever asset is being secured as a property owner. And so all property owners know what is the set of rights that they obtain from them because of the fact that it's property. And they know these base rules. For instance, you have to provide express restrictions and have notice and things of that sort, regardless of whether it's land or other type of tangible resource like water or spectrum, for all of these reasons that these are property rights, and therefore you achieve efficiencies in the marketplace. You achieve kind of this is the efficient operation and deployment of assets for productive use in the marketplace and for ultimately deployment to consumers who purchase them at very low prices. And so what we're now achieving is, well, you actually have this absolute per se rule on exhaustion except for seeds. And then they'll carve out some other type of exception. And then they'll carve out some other type of exception as they're continually pointed out that this is going to cause problems because the very function and nature of the massive R&D investments that have to be undertaken, even in the high-tech space by companies like Microsoft and Qualcomm and others, which is, invest billions of dollars a year in R&D to come up with their technological innovation, that they're going to then need these types of restrictions in order to maximize the economic returns in order to recoup their R&D and deploy products in the marketplace in an efficient way. And so what you end up with is then a fragmented system which creates inefficiencies because then people always won't necessarily know what are the set of rights that are coming to them because it's not a single stable platform property, it's some other type of interest, now a monopoly regulatory entitlement. And on top of that, what you are creating is a public interest nightmare, because once you create very focused exceptions and exemptions for particularized companies and fields of work in a particular area of the innovation economy, you create opportunities and incentives for people to engage in lobbying and rent-seeking at Congresses, with Congress, with regulatory agencies, and with the courts ultimately as well, where people try to focus their energies in order to get whatever short-term gains they can out of the system. And so, again, this just shows how this decision in impression products continues to move us away from a proper property rights understanding of patents, which is what this country embraced at core, in essence, with of course, some exceptions like Chief Justice Taney, and there were some other few. You could point to some other outlier decisions as well. But at core, what was a property rights approach versus what we're now seeing, which is more of a monopoly government entitlement approach to patents.
Great. Let's go to our next question.
Hi. I was just wondering if this decision, although I know it has strictly to do with selling a product rather than a license, has any effect on the SEP FRAND debate, and if the experts had any opinions on that front.
Well, Kristen is actually a scholar of SEPs and SSOs and whatnot, so she may want to jump in as moderator and take moderator privilege to answer that question.
I don't have a whole lot of deep thoughts on the issue. The Supreme Court, in the opinion, went to great pains to distinguish licenses from patents, and a lot of what is occurring with SEPs and products made under standard really falls into the licensing rather than the sale category. So I hadn't really thought too deeply about it. I'm sure Adam's thought much more deeply than I have. But to me, I think that SEPs are still going to fall out into that licensing area, that there is no title being transferred. And so this opinion, I don't believe, is going to have a great impact on that. Adam, do you have any other thoughts?
I generally agree with you, I think, precisely because FRAND is a license. It's not an assignment. It's not a transfer of the interest. And so the distinction between that the court made between licenses and assignments will save SEPs and owners of SEPs from some of the negative consequences of this decision. But with that said, the Chief Justice Roberts did go out of his way also to make the point that, by the way, patent owners, don't think you can get around my per se exhaustion rule by framing a transfer as a license. That's just a label. We are going to look at the actual nature of the transfer. It has to be actually a license and not an assignment. Assignment is the term from common law real property doctrine for transferring all of your interests, an outright sale of your interests. So there you may get some satellite litigation on those types of topics, but I don't think it'll impact SEPs in any particularly hard way. It'll be similar types of litigation that you would see in other areas of the innovation economy.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any from the audience. Kristen, do you have any you'd like to ask?
I kind of have a broader, maybe a more of a wrap-up type question, but if there's no questions from the audience, I'll go ahead and ask that.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. So this year, the last year, the last couple years, the Supreme Court certainly has been taking a lot more patent cases, either to the delight or dismay of patent attorneys. You can put yourself in one of those two boxes. How does this case, in your mind, Adam and Steve, how does this case fit into the other patent or intellectual property cases that the Supreme Court has been deciding? Is this just more of the same? Are they following the same trajectory, or is this different in any way than the IP cases that the Supreme Court's recently given us?
Steve, do you want to take
go
a first crack
Adam,
at that?
And I'll follow on.
Okay, I don't want to dominate the discussion. So the Supreme Court is deciding patent cases at a rate that we haven't seen since the late 19th century, and that's actually quite significant, if only because the Supreme Court didn't even have control over its docket at that time. So this was before the writ of certiorari was created for the Supreme Court by Congress, and so it's very significant that the Supreme Court is on its own, by its own choice, is engaging with patent law and has been ruling on patent doctrines at this very high rate. And as a general matter, in the past 10 years, aside from a few cases here and there, the overall pattern of the decisions have been resulted in eliminating or restricting the rights of patent owners, sometimes outright eliminating them, which is in a series of four opinions that the Supreme Court issued over the span of several years in what's known as patent eligibility doctrine, what counts as a patentable invention. But the Supreme Court has also made it harder for patent owners to obtain injunctions as property rights owners, removing the presumption of an injunction that all property rights owners have, except for patent owners. This is not its first time that it's weighed in on licensing. As I said, for example, the Quanta computer decision in 2008, and before that in 2007, there was another decision in MedImmune involving licensees and whether they had to actually breach the license and become an infringer in order to challenge the validity of the patent that they had licensed. And the court said, yes, you can, which means that that a licensee can actually challenge the patent that they're licensed under without the patent owner being able to countersue them for infringement. So that's a kind of tails I win, heads you lose situation for patent owners, and so on and so on. The impact in the past 10 years has been an extreme narrowing and, as I mentioned, outright elimination of patent rights in some areas, and so a large across the scale devaluation of patents, such that it's now entirely a plausible business model for companies to make a cost-benefit assessment and decide, well, it's cheaper for us to infringe and drag patent owners through the process and cost of litigation because they're either not going to be able to sue us because we'll either wipe out the patent, or even if they do succeed in suing us, they're not going to be able to get an injunction, and we can convince the judge to hand down a very, very limited damage award, and so we end up paying less anyway. This term has a new term has been coined. In fact, it's called efficient infringement, that it's now more efficient to infringe property rights, and just like with efficient infringement or efficient breach of contracts or efficient infringement of property rights to land, this is actually improper because it creates systemic problems and broader costs to the system. You see the same problems here, which is that with the loss of incentives and the loss of the ability to return on your investments in the creation of these types of new innovative technological assets, especially all of the kind of the biomedical treatments that now have made life in the 21st century a virtual miracle compared to what it was like 100 years ago, people are investing less, and they're going to be creating less of these resources and creating less of these assets, and so we are either going to result in having less technology and less biomedical products in the future, or what's going to happen, and we're already seeing this, is that you're seeing an offshoring of this to other countries, such as China and the EU, where they are providing protections that we are no longer providing. And so when you talk to venture capitalists today, they say actually that they're seeing and they're sending their dollars to China to invest in patented innovation over there because those patents are actually worth something, that because you can still get an injunction in China and you're not and you don't have these other types of restrictions like the impression products decision restrictions that we just saw. So this is a real concern. We're going to start losing economic growth, we're going to start losing jobs, and we're going to start losing all overall innovation in this country if we continue down this path.
So I'll just build on that a little bit without disagreeing with anything Adam just said. I see a few different factors coming into play here. I'm hardly the first to suggest that or observe that the Supreme Court is unimpressed with the jurisprudence coming out of the Federal Circuit these days. One might say the Federal Circuit is the new Ninth Circuit, going back a few years. So there's that. Those of you familiar with Lexmark and its printer cartridge business know that they've been litigating, Lexmark has been litigating this issue through a variety of IP provisions for well over a decade now. In fact, their first attempt was to use the anti-circumvention rules from the Digital Millennium Copyright Act from 1998 to argue that the people refilling the cartridges were hacking into the computer program on a chip on the cartridge, which communicates with the printer to verify that the cartridge is valid and should allow the machine to operate. And the Sixth Circuit was unimpressed with that argument. In fact, Lexmark has lost every one of these attempts. Courts seem singularly unimpressed with the use of IP to reduce this aftermarket competition. And I, for one, can't help but wonder how much that factored into this decision. And Adam's notation earlier that Chief Justice Roberts relied on a series of antitrust cases, it makes me wonder how much antitrust was on his mind in this regard as much as patents. All that said, I do want to note that at least in the copyright space, there have been a series of very good pro-copyright decisions coming out of the Supreme Court as well. Just in the last couple of terms, you've got the Varsity Brands case, the Aereo case. Going just a few years back further, there's Eldred, Grokster, Golan. So without at all disagreeing with Adam that the standards of patentability that the court has been articulating are deeply problematic, I think intellectual property writ large, it would be a mistake and inaccurate to label this court as anti-IP.
I actually want to agree wholeheartedly with Steve about that. And there are a lot of commentators, especially in the patent space, who feel like the court has become anti-patent. And unfortunately, I think that is somewhat of a misnomer. Yes, as a de facto result of the pattern of these decisions, what you are getting is a very anti-patent trend in the law in this area. But the court itself, as I believe Steve rightly noted, is in part responding to perceived excesses by the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, the Court of Appeals that has sole jurisdiction to hear all patent appeals. So what's consistent in all of these cases is that the court is overruling the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, and the Court of Appeals for Federal Circuit's decisions, which the court has shown displeasure in because they've tended to be, as framed by the complaints and by the court in some of its past decisions, as formalistic, as mechanistic, and as too hard, a bright line and too hard-nosed, had tended to be in favor of patent owners. So by overruling those decisions, they've also been ruling in favor of patent owners. But through this kind of incremental process of continually overruling the Federal Circuit, they have created a body of decisions that together, as a de facto matter, as I said, are anti-patent. Also, the court has shown, though, in the past couple years, more and more that they have been reading the New York Times, the classic adage, the Supreme Court does eventually follow the pages of the New York Times. They have been paying attention to the broader policy debates about so-called patent trolls, this rhetorical epithet that has played a significant role by companies lobbying in Washington, D.C. to weaken patent rights through proposed legislation. And so, for instance, you had Justice Scalia use the term patent troll in one of his final opinions from the last session in which he sat on the court. And you can see concerns about this in other opinions, such as in T.C. Hartland, which was decided a couple weeks before Impression Products, and in other areas where they seem to be reacting to this to a broader debate in the policy world, in which there is a substantial amount of rhetoric and for lack of a term, junk science, statistical claims being thrown around about whether patent litigation is out of control, whether there are more bad quality of patents today relative to past years and things of that sort. So this is. So overall, I agree with Steve that that there's a complex set of factors as to what's motivating the court to what it's doing, and certainly part of it is not an animus towards patent, but just more of a concern about what's happening at the Federal Circuit. But that has resulted in decisions that are not favorable for patent owners.
Great, thanks, guys. Laura, do we have any other questions?
Not at this time. I'll make a final call for questions. To ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any. Would you all like to make some final remarks?
Steve, do you want to go first since I went first on the panel?
Sure. To be honest, I don't have anything prepared for final remarks, so I'll just repeat the observation that the Lexmark versus Impression Products decision, I think, is problematic and lacks the precedent that the decision seems to suggest it has in terms of international exhaustion. It struck me as unfortunate that the court not only took this policy turn, but that it was almost derisive of views to the contrary, including the views of the Justice Department, which is somewhat unusual, and I think unjustified, frankly, in this instance. And then in terms of the domestic licensing versus patenting issue, for whatever the court had to say about the scope of patent rights and what it was going to look to determine whether or not something was in fact a sale of a product, the court very clearly did not touch the enforceability of the contract terms of a license. And so that is very clearly the way things are going to go forward. Now, that's practically less efficient for potential plaintiffs. It's less desirable because both the Patent Act and the Copyright Act have remedies that are superior to contract suit remedies. Nonetheless, there's an avenue for the business side, the marketplace, to continue doing, at least to some degree, what has been going on for a very long time. And I hope that this court, the court's decision, will not be as disruptive in the marketplace as it appears to be in the legal sector.
And for myself, I agree with Steve that owners of patent innovation will find a way, just as all commercial producers and creators in the United States innovation economy for the past 150 years, when faced with massive regulatory controls and restrictions on what they can do with their property and in their commercial transactions, have found ways, nonetheless, to continue to come up with new values that have benefited all of us and have advanced our economy and made our lives today the just incredible flourishing lives that that, as I mentioned, would be thought of as miracles, even 100 years ago. And so I'm certain that the people in the innovation industries will find a way. They will find kind of complex new ways to use licenses to create the privity of contract that Steve described that will ensure that they would be able to sue for what normally they could sue more efficiently for as a breach of their property right. The problem with that, of course, is that these then become the hidden costs of these kind of de facto type of regulatory decisions that we've seen in impression products, where the court is achieving as a court matter what, you know, the regulatory state would normally achieve outright with just in regulation, with the elimination of property rights. And so these additional kind of complex and unnecessary commercial transactions will be costs that companies will bear and that they will then transfer the costs onto us. So what we'll end up with is more expensive products. because companies will not be able to engage in the outright price discrimination that they've been engaging in through the types of restrictive conditions that they've been imposing for well over 200 years, as I mentioned. And so we will then end up with more expensive products and less money to spend on other aspects of our lives, and that will impact our quality of life. And this will just be the underlying hidden cost of the ongoing ways in which the government interferes with our ability to live our lives. So something that I think that is of real concern and recognized as such by members of the Federalist Society.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.